Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Hey, welcome. It's the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilmer and Tom Shand. And no matter where our listeners happen to be, unless you're down probably somewhere south of the Florida Keys, chances are you're experiencing some rather cold and probably unusually stormy weather, even for the winter time. Where Mike and I hail from, up in the Northeast, it's been one storm after another. Very cold, extremely just brutal weather. Some traveling that both of us have recently done. We're working outside in below zero weather, which for us old guys, we'd much rather be sitting around a table drinking coffee and talking shop. So, Brother Michael, how you doing up there? You got the fireplace going? What's happening?
Yeah, we finally have some sun. Although it's still not above freezing, out on the back deck it's 28 degrees as we are recording this broadcast, but it looks like we might get above freezing this afternoon, and it's only the second day above freezing in all of February. So, like you said, very cold, very snowy, have 4 feet of snow in my yard right now. And it doesn't look like it's going anywhere anytime soon with the prognostication of the weather people. It looks like it's going to continue to maybe have a warm day, but then have several days of brutal cold again for the foreseeable future. So we are in winter's grip. I have a few accidents I would like to share with you and our listeners of some kind of noteworthiness. There was a fire chief that was hurt after he was working on an acquired military tanker. And it appears from what was written about this that the fire chief smelt or saw battery acid, opened up the hood to this truck, and the whole truck just exploded. And his injuries were pretty serious. He still, as of this writing, has his jaw wired shut, had some facial lacerations and some other injuries. He's out of the hospital now, but he has a ways to go as far as recovery. And for our listeners, particularly our young listeners, many of the newer batteries are enclosed in apparatus with just a sight window, and there's really not much to check, but Brother Tom and I for sure remember the days of checking the apparatus and having what was then called a hydrometer, where you would check to make sure that the acid level in the battery was proper and was the proper mixture and all that stuff of acid and water. And you would do that routinely at the 9 a.m. Truck check. And basically, what it appears happened to this chief is that he had a miniature reenactment of the Hindenburg disaster, which takes us way back in history, certainly to the point before I was born, where a blimp, a dirigible, was filled with hydrogen gas, and it caught fire and exploded in Lindenhurst, New Jersey, I think back in the 30s. And that's similar to the condition here with the battery. I worked in an industrial battery factory for a couple of years before I got on the fire department, and it was not unusual to have batteries exploding and lead plates flying and pretty scary stuff. So our thoughts and prayers go out to the chief and hoping for a speedy recovery for him. Next, and this is kind of a sign of the time. Took it off the emergency vehicle response website. Funds were nixed to repair city's only ladder truck in Indiana. The Common Council said not tonight to Chiefs request for money to repair the department's 75-foot aerial truck. However, the chief said that's not going to stop him. He's going to start to get it fixed anyway. Any comments on that as far as budgets and maintenance and trying to get stuff fixed or repaired or even buy new, Brother Tom?
I think for some of our long-term listeners, they've probably heard us on more than a couple occasions kind of almost get preachy in talking about apparatus maintenance. It appears that the industry is starting to come out of the doldrums a little bit as a result of the weakness of the economy, and people are starting to buy new fire apparatus. So that's a positive thing, Mike. What both of us are constantly seeing, though, is that maintenance, routine preventative maintenance on vehicles continues in many locations, even when the brothers and sisters will say to a person, well, we have a pretty stout apparatus maintenance program, so-and-so, we've got an in-house mechanic, or, we contract out and so-and-so does our work and they've got a very good reputation. All that stuff is fine, yet to go to Mike's point, just talking about the poor fire chief who had the battery explode, there's very few fire trucks anymore that don't have the semblance of some type of onboard battery charger. Yet, because of all the ancillary appliances that we've added to the vehicles over the period of years with thermal imaging cameras, possibly, now having a portable radio for each person, which certainly is a very valuable tool, but all these other things that have had drains on electrical systems, we get into these cold snaps where now the apparatus goes out of a nice, warm, comfortable environment, goes out into the brutal cold, units sitting there operating for extended period of times, many times, unfortunately, at idle speeds. Just the electrical systems just takes an absolute beating on these vehicles. We get back to quarters. Hopefully, maybe at least we give the top side a little bath and clean them up, and we call it good. We were in a couple of stations here recently within the last 3 or 4 months where during routine morning checkouts, they find a vehicle that's just dead, won't start. Now, it's got 4 or 6 battery pack system. It's got an onboard charger. Maybe the charger's not up to snuff in terms of what it should be putting out to keep the battery system up. And in a couple of cases, we find, well, here's a vehicle. Now we got to take the one unit out of service because it won't start. I don't know, Mike. Some things that you would think that you would do on a routine, at least weekly basis, if not in departments where there's full time staffing to do it on a daily basis, is I think we've gotten somewhat lax in our routines. Part of that might be at least out here in the East, there's not a whole lot of departments where they have a specific dedicated driver. In many cases, it rotates through. It can be the senior man. In some cases, it's somebody that, not to say that, newer firefighters are not, not enthusiastic about the job, but they just don't have the experience or the knowledge that have maybe, unfortunately, not been passed down from a prior operator, to the point that they just take for granted, well, we run it, and when something breaks, we call the mechanic. Well, that's, that might be the internal answer, but that doesn't help you in from the overall maintenance program. And in places where money is tight and they have career staffing and they're looking to save money, I think it goes without saying almost the two most common things you hear is that, well, our training budget was cut and they've cut the maintenance budget. Well, okay, training, you can argue that. Could you defer some training for 4 to 6 months, maybe till you get into the new budget year in July. Okay, that, you know, that's not good, but that's not a showstopper. When we can't perform the service, provide the services to our community because our apparatus is not up to snuff, I think it's great that we've got, over the course of the last several years, increased awareness about our physical health in terms of taking care of our own bodies. And that's great because we need to perform when we arrive at the scene of the emergency incident. But from what Michael and I are seeing, there's a lot of cases that we are deferring the physical welfare and health of the vehicles, the very vehicles that we're relying upon to get us to the scene of the incident. And we have come across some things that you wouldn't have to be a PhD to figure this out by just doing a walk around the rig and getting on a creeper and going underneath it. And some of the things we're finding, all I can say is pretty scary stuff, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. Absolutely. Not great, for sure. Another incident, and I don't know if this is going to stop, honestly. A fire chief was hit, killed, and backed over by his own fire truck. It's just, and I don't mean to get on a soapbox, folks, but in 2015, with backup cameras, with rules in place that have been around for decades about the need for a spotter, we continue to back over, in many cases, our own people and kill them at an average of one or two a year for the past several decades. And to me, in 2015, with radios and backup cameras and communication and training and rules, it's just unconscionable to me that we would take a fire truck and back over somebody when everybody knows, right down to the last person, that you need a spotter before you move the truck. It just almost to the point of driving me crazy, because I remember one time I wrote an article for Firehouse Magazine, spent 40 hours at least on that article, went out to Edwards Air Force Base and took 11 pictures of ex-military folks that joined the fire department there and were in the employ of the fire department. Whether you know it or not, the military has a book, a 35-page book of just hand signals for their operations, and we took some of those to get some kind of continuity to bring them to the fire service, and spent a lot of time on this article. It was the most pictures that Firehouse ever printed under my column heading at 11 of the different hand signals that a spotter needs to use to prevent a tragedy like this. And that article went to print, I think it was in like September or October, and by December somebody had backed over the fire chief in Wisconsin and killed him. We haven't, unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you want to look at it, we have not found a new way to kill ourselves. We continue to kill firefighters the same ways that we've been killing them for the last 100 years. And I don't know when, quite frankly, the madness is going to stop.
Mike, I can't agree more. I think too many times we rely upon the, I'll call it, for lack of a better term, the easy way out. I was recently came back from a apparatus final inspection at an installation and saw just about every vehicle had a backup camera. Several of those had a backup camera as not only rear mounted, but both left and right side cameras, which are fine, excellent safety devices. To have another device referred to as a backstop device across the rear bumper. Lord knows we've had mandatory backup alarms of different descriptions on vehicles. And yet, let's take away the tragedy for a moment of the injuries and the loss of life. We still have apparatus backing accidents where only for the grace of God that we don't injure or kill somebody. But we just back into something that we hit And had we been following the rules and regulations of using a spotter and being trained in this, it's probably no different, Mike, than, you know, why we experience so many on-the-job injuries of slips, falls, or off of vehicles. We talk about back to basics. Maybe back to basics is like, how do you back up a fire truck? And that just means more than punching it in R, checking the mirrors left and right, and just going to have at it. We need to really, really think about the everyday things that we do and train them in a safe and sane manner so that they do become second nature. If it took you more than a couple of days when you were a youngster to figure out how to tie your shoes, okay, that's fine. Not everybody gets it in the first hour. It's no different than they talk about riding a bike. Some I can remember as a youngster having a neighborhood kid who I was envious of because his parents, there's only two kids in the family and had a little more money, and he got his new 26-inch bike and just got on the thing and took off down the road and looked at me like, you know, I was still trying to figure out how to get on the thing, right? Well, not all of us get it at the same time, but if we don't all get it at the same time and we're not all operating in the same, as Michael refers to it when he does the driving class, a safe and sane manner, it's only a matter of time that sooner rather than later we're going to injure or kill somebody, and you certainly don't want to be on that end or that side of the equation.
Well, thank you for that commentary. It's just truly sad and just so preventable when you come to incidents like that. And finally, to keep in step with the season, in Texas yesterday, which is going through a horrendous ice storm, the fire truck down there skidded and actually got run into by somebody else on the icy roads. So particularly if you're out there and you're driving, whether it's your personal car or vehicle or the fire truck, the best way to keep control of your vehicle is to slow down. You can't, particularly for fire and EMS responses, you can't travel at the same speed and expect to get to an address location in the same amount of time with a half inch of ice or 6 inches of snow on the ground than you could have in July on a hot sunny day. If you try to overdrive the apparatus during periods of inclement weather, you are almost for sure going to wreck the vehicle. And there's a couple, again, in the last month of tankers that have rolled over, leaving the road. That right front tire gets off on the loose stuff. People panic and try to start jerking the wheel. You can jerk the wheel all you want, but the reality is that at 8 pounds a gallon in a 3,000-gallon tank, you have 24,000 pounds plus the water weight in motion. And physics and gravity and centripetal and centrifugal force don't allow you to change the direction of that much weight in motion just by a steering wheel. And so you're going to get into trouble early and often. And the best way to avoid all that in this bad weather is just to slow down and keep control of the vehicle and understand that you don't do any good if you don't get there. And so if it takes another 5 minutes to get there because of the weather conditions, folks, that's what it takes. And nobody is going to fault you for that. But what they will fault you for is if you try to overdrive the apparatus and end up wrecking it, and then somebody gets hurt or killed either in the wreck or at the fire, and nobody will be able to forgive themselves after that. So slow and steady wins the race when it comes to inclement weather driving. Next, we turn the page here, and Brother Tom and I have done a number of fleet evaluations recently and had the occasion to see many, many fire trucks from all different vendors, all different ages, all different colors, descriptions, and kinds, and wanted to share some insight on several really important issues, several of them being certainly corrosion. And we visited one department in Pennsylvania that had an 03 truck built by a manufacturer and an 09 truck built by the same manufacturer. And the 09 truck had significant rust on the frame rails, and yet the 03 truck didn't. What can you attribute that to, Brother Tom?
Well, Mike, there's a number of things that have occurred depending upon geographically, you know, where you live. So let's talk about that first. While we are, you know, doing this podcast, there are areas of the country that are getting snow and ice down even into the Texas area, places in Tennessee and Kentucky, areas down even around in the Atlanta, Georgia area, where people typically don't get that type of foul weather. So when the apparatus, to go to Mike's point, is out operating in that, while you may have a very, very experienced driver, chauffeur, engineer, whatever you call them, they may have very, very little practical experience in vehicle operations during inclement weather. So if you live up in anywhere in the Northeast where highway departments and regional DOT organizations pre-treat the roads with salt brine, or they're using different magnesium chloride chemicals, in some areas of the country where they haven't had that type of weather, they've been only using those chemicals for, you know, several years, where up in the Northeast, it's been pretty common practice that people have gone from just using, you know, sand and cinders to, you know, salt, and then pre-wetting the salt so that it actually stays on the road. And with the last 2 to 3 years of having these unusually long duration snow events and frankly just a longer than average winter, if you think about your apparatus, if you haven't done anything differently in those last couple of years, these chemicals are now basically attacking and causing rust and corrosion on the underside of your apparatus. So no matter who built your fire truck, you can have an aluminum cab or a stainless steel cab and body work, but certainly even if you have a like-and-kind body substructure of aluminum or stainless, what's still holding your vehicle up, no matter who built it, no matter what the nameplate says on the front, whether it's custom or commercial, you have steel frame rails, steel cross members, and innumerable steel brackets that in many cases are holding the diesel fuel tanks, the air reservoirs, and other components on the unit. And being on the underside of the vehicle, they are all subject to these road chemicals as you travel up and down the road. Consider for the moment that even if you weather the storm and you only have a couple of runs during the actual storm event itself where there's snow and ice down on the road, and then eventually you get the warm-up, which we all applaud for. They say, okay, finally, it's above freezing. And the next run you take out, that you go out, the rig just gets wet. And you come back from that run, and if you're in a modest fire department, hopefully you're giving the rig a bath at least once a day. In some cases, if it's smaller departments, the regulation is every time the rig goes out, it's going to get washed. So you may wash the top side, you may wash out the step area so it doesn't get accumulation of snow and ice for the next time you got to get in and out of the cab or step on the rear tailboard. But what's happening to the underside? All of that stuff that's on the road that's wet gets trapped up inside there, and the difference between those two units that Michael mentioned is that with something as simple as the older unit, the department had made the decision at the time to have the frame rails and the running gear painted vehicle color. And it's not that we're worrying about show or making it look good. It's the fact that you have, even at the lowest, simplest level of protection, you've now got a level of paint on all of those components that typically would come in just a powder-coated black color, or in some cases they'll paint them, as the manufacturers sometimes just call it, chassis black. Then you have things where if you have an auxiliary pump, a hydraulic pump for an aerial or for a PTO-driven system or for a hydraulic generator, most manufacturers, unless you write your specs, they'll take the hydraulic pump and some of the PTO components, the way they come from the manufacturer, and whatever way they come, they get bolted into the chassis frame, and in some cases, we've seen it's primer red, right? You get those components exposed to several years of these road chemicals, and it's not hard to find a 3 or 4 year old rig that you crawl underneath and look at it, and you think you're looking at a 15 or 20 year old rig. So what do you do to protect it? At the very least, you get all of those components and make sure that when the vehicle is new, you get them finished painted. What do you do if you've got, no matter how old your unit is, Mike, if you get that rust and corrosion, you got to get it to a place where they can get the truck up on a lift. And this maybe might be your local fire equipment repair place. Maybe it's not. You need to take it to some place where you can get to the underside of it. They can steam clean the underside of the chassis and then do some investigation. There's several different components. Products that are available that can then be sprayed on there, and it won't take away the existing rust and corrosion, but it will basically coat it and protect it, the remaining components, to mitigate it so that it will not rust or corrode additionally. If our listeners are really interested in doing this, we would suggest that you maybe go investigate and go talk to your local highway superintendent or the person that manages the fleet for your town highway department. If you're in the area where you've got snow, it's not uncommon to find snow plows that are the same age or older than our fire apparatus, and they obviously are exposed in a much worse condition than our vehicles because they're out there spreading these chemicals and material. And find out what those folks are doing. We're not here to promote or push any product, but if you do some investigation, you'll find out that there are things out there that maybe traditionally have not been done fleet-wise with fire apparatus to protect the most important asset of our vehicle, and that's the frame and the other steel components. Now, you buy a new fire truck today, to go one step further, Mike, there are people that offer different types of anti-corrosion processes for these components. There's a couple of manufacturers that are offering galvanized frame rails and cross members that may pique your interest, but the importance there is, like with most things, buyer beware. Find out what the system is, find out what it covers, and most importantly, read the statement of warranty that if you're going to pay to get an improved process on a new fire truck, find out what that warranty covers, and most importantly, read the fine print. Find out what it might not cover, if that makes sense.
Just to pedal back a little bit, in comparing the 03 that did not rust and painting the undercarriage and the 09 that's going to need significant rust abatement now, what are the two costs at each of those times in comparison for our audience?
Well, it's going to vary a little bit from manufacturer to manufacturer, but you can get finished painted frame rails and running gear and components, and that will typically range anywhere maybe from a low of around $850 to $900. So I think the highest price we've ever heard, Mike, has been $1,300 or $1,400. And not to diminish, in fact, to say that that's an insignificant sum of money, but if you're spending $400,000 to $500,000 for a pumper and close to $1 million for a ladder truck, that additional cost is money well spent, and not that Michael and I don't like, you know, flashy looking rigs, but spending $1,000 there to protect the vehicle against rust and corrosion as compared to worrying about, you know, having the one-off, one-of-a-kind light bar that just cost you $8,000. It cost you $2,500 more than the standard one. I'm going for longevity. You know, if you are truly interested in having a fire vehicle go 10, 12, 15 years, all right, without having to do some midlife crisis rehab work and rust prevention and abatement, you need to spend that little bit of money up front. If you do, it will be well served. And as we've heard most recently, actually, Mike, in a meeting with a department where we were talking about this rust corrosion and preventative measures and things that need to be done to make the vehicle last 20 years, if that's the intent. I actually had somebody mention, and it was part in jest, but I think part truthful, like, well, hey, we really don't care because I'm going to be retired in 20 years. You know, we just want what we want now. Fleet maintenance and rust corrosion and preventative measures are something that need to be done and need to be done up front and taken care of at the time. If you didn't do it at the time you bought the vehicle, there's still time in its history for you to be able to do some corrective measures to be able to fix the unit before it gets to the point that you've got a cracked frame rail and the rig's not worth anything, and now you're taking it out of service.
Thank you. Thank you for those comments, Brother Tom. Next, we'd like to head to something that we don't see as much of, but it's still out there. Compartments that aren't properly vented, and what does that do in the overall mix of corrosion on the vehicle?
All right, we've noticed over the course of the last couple of years, and probably can go back further. It's immaterial what time frame you want to look at. Increasing emphasis on wanting more compartment space on the body, which means things like our ground ladders, hooks, short Fresno ladders, folding ladders, A-frame ladders, and in some cases where people feel compelled, they still need to carry hard suction, but now they want to get everything enclosed inside the body somehow. That's one thing. For a while, there was a big play where people say, well, if you wanted to get full height compartments on both sides of the body, the easy way to do that is we'll just take the ground ladders and enclose the ground ladders somehow within the water tank, either through the tank flat or up on beam vertically to the left or to the right side. And all that stuff is fine, but if you don't provide some mechanism to have an exchange of air in there, what happens? The condensation when we go in this climate from the 65-degree station floor and go outside to now where it's 10, 20, or below zero, come back into the station, you get condensation builds up in those kinds of compartments, in underbody compartments on rescue trucks, Mike, where we've got carrying shoring material, in some cases high lift jacks or other odd-shaped stuff that doesn't fit well within the body. And unless you provide ventilation to allow an exchange of air from the outside to get inside there, you get condensation and corrosion, which results in corrosion. So on ground ladders, you look many times, the ladder locks, the poles, the pulleys where the halyard goes over, the butt spurs on the bottom of the ladder, they're all rusted and corroded because you just have this condensation that builds up that forces corrosion. Even if you look inside, it's a hinge door, and look at the latch, typically most of those little D-ring latches, while it's stainless steel on the outside, that's all cadmium-plated or zinc-plated hardware on the inside. You open it up, and on a two-year-old rig, it's completely rusted. Why is that? Because there's no ventilation in there. So it's one thing to package the apparatus body to the point where you don't see anything on the outside. And it's not that Michael and I are against that. But when you package the vehicle so tightly to the point where now there's no way to get air exchange into these all these little compartments that you have, it becomes proverbially counterproductive, and that's where you get rust and corrosion. So the water tank's not rusted, but you can look on the inside in the summertime. You can open up the compartment, shine a LED hand light down here, and you can see the condensation just building up alongside the wall of the poly tank. Well, where's that water going? It's going down. I'm going to lay down into the floor, and depending upon what type of slide material they used for the ladders, you've just designed something that's rusting from the inside out. Now, it's something, again, that needs to be corrected. If you have, there are some possibilities. You can add compartment vents or add some ventilation in there. And if not, then you just need to increase your maintenance a little bit, which goes about back to what we talked about. You know, people open up, you know, we just can't use this stuff and then just throw it back in the body and just like, okay, it's good. We'll take care of it. You know, we'll let the next shift worry about it, I guess is the most recent joke, you know, we heard. To me, a well-designed and well-maintained piece of apparatus that is ready to go to work from everything from clean hand tools without rust that's marked and identified if you've got multiple units in the department. So if there's a set of irons sitting there, you know that they belong to you. You can look at the color coding system right away. And ideally then when they go back on the vehicle, it's labeled and marked and they're properly secured, you know, within the body. We've come light years ahead of what we're able to do in terms of tool mounting and equipment mounting inside the body, and that's great. But as Michael and I have found in a lot of cases, you just look at the condition of those tools, and it's like we've just gone from the last couple of fires, and our job is that, you know, we're just here to use the stuff. We're not really here to take care of it or clean it or maintain it. And that's rather bothersome to me, Mike.
Yeah, me as well, Brother Tom, me as well. Our next point of corrosion, and we're seeing an uptick in this, that's kind of disconcerting, is dissimilar metals. Can you explain to our listeners what that phenomena is, what you can do to protect your apparatus from that, and what you write in a specification to make sure that it's done?
It's almost impossible to build a fire truck where you're not going to have, in some location, have a dissimilar metal. Let's just take a standard aluminum body, where even if you had roll-up shutter doors, so the shutter doors are anodized aluminum, but as we were just talking about, at the rear of the body, we've got two enclosed compartments, one that's just enclosed in some dead space that you wanted to enclose it, and the other one is a vertically hinged door on the right-hand side to enclose your ground ladders and your hooks and your folding ladder. Well, the door's made of aluminum. The latch itself is typically made out of stainless steel. The hinge is made out of stainless steel. So what you can do in between where the stainless steel overlaps the aluminum, that can be dielectric tape that you can put there. Sometimes there's different types of mastic material that actually gets sprayed or laid on there. Before, and just about everybody in the industry now is as standard, is using stainless steel fasteners. It was back 8-10 years ago, there still were some vendors that were using, zinc or cadmium plated hardware that had a life expectancy of about, 18 to 20 months before you would get some type of corrosion. So you can write those types of requirements into the specification to minimize the areas where you're going to have this corrosion. Where it typically shows its face, Mike, is, again, we're talking about Northeast experiences here. In year 3 to 5, all right, you've got the stainless steel hinge. So here's a good example, all right? We asked for the unit to be, obviously, be finished painted, all right? But your manufacturer, you made a change order and decided you wanted to have a rear body electrical outlet run off the generator. So they've now got to cut the hole in the body. Well, the body's already been painted. They cut the hole in the rear of the body to put the nice little polycarbonate cover and outlet with a three-prong, L520 twist lock outlet. But when you go to look at it, you find out, well, where they cut through the body, they now have all these raw metal surfaces, and they're not protected. Well, that's another spot where you're going to get some, at some point you're going to get some corrosion. But in many cases, this dissimilar metal initially surfaces where you've got around door handles, for example, on cabs, pretty common. It's an aluminum cab with, in most cases, a couple of manufacturers build stainless, but by and large, we're dealing with aluminum material on a cab of a couple of different alloys, and we've got a stainless steel door latch or something on the door that's stainless steel, and you will find it start to have this exfoliation corrosion, which will surface with just some little bubbling of paint blisters. Well, that's basically, in many cases, it's the interaction between the two dissimilar metals there, which, again, can be protected with the appropriate gasket material. When the warning lights are attached to the sides of the cab, you have to make sure that they're not forked down to the point where now they break the seal of the gasket. And we've seen rigs as little as 2.5 years old in severe weather climates where you're already getting this exfoliation corrosion. So that probably brings us, Mike, to where I think we might be headed here in our last point of discussion, is about paint warranties. Warranties, just to distill it, is only good as the paper that they're written on. And when we advise or work with a fire department on specifications, we put a lot of requirements in with respect to what we want the bidders to supply for what their warranties are. Because somebody can say, I have a 7-year paint warranty, which is almost pretty much standard throughout the industry. All right. So you say, I have a 7-year paint warranty. Well, then it begs the question, what does the paint warranty cover? All right. But more importantly, with the exclusions, what does it not cover? Because the industry, Mike, is obviously driven by turning a profit, which we need to do to keep everybody in business, right? Many of these paint warranties where they say up front, and you read the verbiage in the specification, say it's a 7-year paint warranty. When you actually read the statement of warranty, which is a separate standalone document that says, this is what we cover, but more importantly, Mr. and Mrs. Fire Department, this is what we don't cover, you find that that paint warranty is what we refer to as a prorated warranty, which means it only covers some things 100% for 7 years, and other things, like in some cases, dissimilar metals or this paint blistering or corrosion, right, it covers it for 36 months, and then the amount of coverage. By coverage means if you have a problem in year 5, and let's say it costs $500 to fix it, well, if it's prorated and say at the 5-year mark, we're gonna cover 60% of that cost. They're gonna cover $300 of the $500 cost for the paint warranty. So, the proof's in the pudding. It depends. If you have never had paint issues, you know, we can take the desert Southwest. If you're in the Valley of the Sun in the Phoenix area, chances are, other than maybe paint delamination or paint fading because of the UV rays, chances are you probably don't have a severe corrosion issue if you live in that climate. If you're up in the Northeast or in an area up around in the Chicago area, up in what people refer to it as the traditional Rust Belt, corrosion is your enemy, whether it's attacking your frame or attacking other parts of the painted surfaces of your body. So you need to be cognizant of that and develop a specification that, to the point, to a reasonable point, without getting ridiculous, it covers the interests of your fire department in terms of, if you've had issues in the past, to be able to satisfactorily address those. So when you're meeting with your friendly apparatus salesperson, it's one thing to ask them, what's your paint warranty? But at that time, if you know, even ask them for that information before you get to the point of the bid. Ask them for a copy of this statement of warranty. Now, there are people that will offer, but it costs more money, a non-prorated warranty, which means for whatever the period of that time is, if you have an issue, they're going to cover it 100%. Chances are that doesn't come for free. You know, it's, quote, not standard. They may tell you it's standard, but it means it's standard and that additional cost is built into the base price. And as most things, Mike, just to wrap up, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, chances are it probably is.
What would be a good recommendation for our listeners that we could give them as far as the paint warranty, particularly in the Rust Belt and the Northeast? What would be a good requirement for that?
I think as a baseline, since the industry has to a point almost standardized in many cases on this 7 year, but it's in many, most cases it's prorated. I think as a starting point, you'd ask for a 7 year non-prorated paint warranty. All right. And hold fast to that. If it costs a little more money, once again, the chances are the upcharge to get to that level of coverage is going to be much less than your cost as the consumer if you have to do some paint restoration work, you know, in years 5, 6, or 7 when you send it out to a body shop. So a 7 year bumper to bumper non-prorated paint warranty to me would be reasonable and a good starting point. If you're able to secure that, you would have, I think, a pretty decent warranty. Again, based on your department's own experience. This is where, you know, people sometimes, Michael, come back and ask us something like, you know, they're arguing about one of your favorite subjects on a ladder truck. You know, should we get a pre-pipe waterway or should we, you know, or not? Or they're buying a platform. Should we buy, get two monitor, you know, one monitor or two monitors? You know, you need to let your own experience be your guide. If you've never had a paint issue on your fire trucks and you're running around in 15-year-old rigs, that's an unusual case, and God bless you. As Mike and I are finding in many departments, we're seeing, you know, 6, 7, and 8-year-old rigs that have significant paint issues. And when you say to them, well, when did this show up? Ah, it started around year 3. Well, did you ever contact the manufacturer? Nah, we contacted him last year, but he set our warranties up. Well, you know, if you don't want to take the initiative to figure this out up front, then you kind of deserve what you get. But if we're looking at, once again, well, you want to keep a fire truck unless you're leasing it and turning it back at year 7. You know, if you want to keep a fire truck 10, 12, 15 years, you need to do your homework and invest the money and the time and the technical expertise up front before you get to that point.
One last question, and then we're going to have to wrap up. We're kind of going full circle here. Frame rails and warranties. We started out with frame rails in this segment, and we're going to kind of end with them. And that warranty is a little tricky as well, is it not?
Yeah. The frame rail warranties cover a structural defect, a crack, all right? A structural issue, which in most cases, when you read those warranties, at the discretion of the manufacturer, all right, that it's deemed that there's an issue with that. Frame rail warranties, just about everyone I've ever read, almost, again, unless you're in the area of you're doing a galvanized frame rail or something like that, frame rails warranties typically specifically exclude rust and corrosion and the impact of things as a result of, you know, road chemicals and things like that. So, again, one of our favorite comments is an educated consumer is our best customer, right? If the problem's already there, it's almost maybe too little too late to then, you know, go back and say, well, we better read the warranty. You probably need to figure that out first, and have a very good handle as to what your coverage is and what your coverage does not excludes.
Well, that is really great information, Brother Tom, as we wrap up here from the cold, snowy Northeast. And Peter, our engineer and producer down in the Dallas area, just getting swamped with ice today. A lot of good information on winter driving and corrosion and warranty protections that you can build into your specifications. Any final thoughts?
Well, for our listeners, Michael and I wish you good health and be safe out there operating in some just extreme, really tough weather conditions here. And at least the initial forecast here, as much as weather forecasters don't have a particularly admirable batting average here lately, it doesn't look like it's going to change here in the next couple of weeks. So everybody, be safe out there, and we look forward to seeing you on the radio or as we go on tour here during the course of the coming year.
Very good. This is Mike Wilbur for Tom Shan and the Apparatus Architects. Be safe out there, and have a great month.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.